7 months of work to get this story, both the written story and the documentary that has been produced as a result of it. That's a lot of, boy, that's a lot of legwork and a lot of financial commitment, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really grateful to work at a place that both is willing to commit that many resources and also has the resources to do it. I mean, I was looking back when we were trying to figure out exactly how long this did take, and I found an email from last April that was sort of like the first question that I asked, or the first time I reached out to somebody to try to get, it started sort of as an idea. And when I pitched the story, I thought, well, this is pretty obscure for ESPN, and I didn't think there was, frankly, a good chance that they were going to greenlight it. But my editor Chris Buckle and my editor on the TV side, Dwayne Bray, I mean, they both saw it immediately for what it could be, and we just sort of went from there.
Let's start with the premise here, Steve. You know, I'm not sure why people want to believe that international sport is apolitical. It certainly works for the IOC and it works for FIFA in putting together what they do and having countries compete under flags and everybody have a kind of a feel-good moment about the world coming together. But, you know, this story, and again, there's as well as a lot of world history over the last 100 years, is about sport as a political weapon in a lot of ways. Could you just talk about, the impetus to write this? And the story is about the Syrian World Cup qualifying campaign that's ongoing mm-hmm. right now, the Syrian national soccer team, and how they're being used by the regime in Syria at this moment. Set the stage for us a little bit, Steve.
Sure. So it sort of began with a question that I had, which was kind of exactly what you're getting at, which is, how can a team that is sponsored by a government that's been widely accused of committing war crimes against its own people, how can it be given a stage to compete to qualify for the World Cup? So it sort of began with that question. And, as we got into it, one of the things that was really interesting was that a number of Syrians were asking the same question, mostly people who had left the country, had fled the country because of the violence, many of them soccer players. And what we learned as we got into it more and more is that soccer, along with many of the weapons that the Assad regime has used to sustain itself, has used soccer as a propaganda tool from the very beginning. They used players from the Syrian Premier League to march forcibly in support of Assad. They've used soccer stadiums around Syria to launch attacks against civilian neighborhoods. Some 38 players from the first and second divisions of the Syrian Premier League have been killed by the regime, according to people who are tracking this kind of thing. More than a dozen players are still missing. That includes star players like a guy named Jihad Kassab, who his family believes was taken to the Sidnaya military prison outside of Damascus. And Sidnaya is actually in the news today because the U.S. government has released images that say there's a crematorium on the premises that has been used to destroy bodies, and organizations like Amnesty International have put forth evidence that shows that thousands and thousands of Syrians have been killed in mass hangings and other executions at that prison. So soccer has sort of become woven into the whole sort of grisly narrative of Syria. And so the World Cup team is caught in the middle of it, and eventually the people who have been studying this issue brought a case to FIFA to try to persuade FIFA that Syria should not be allowed to compete. The case was brought by a former player, Ayman Khashid, on the premise that FIFA has rules on its books that political interference in soccer is a violation of its rules, and they've used that they've used those rules to suspend countries from international play like nearly two dozen times over the last decade. But in this case, Khashid brought his evidence to FIFA, and FIFA basically punted and said, you know, this goes way beyond the domain of sporting matters, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, you know, and again, with Russia hosting the next World Cup, and Russia a very strong supporter of the Assad regime, you know, there's a bit of connect the dots there, it would appear.
Exactly, and you know, FIFA's in the same position as everybody else, really, is sort of deciding what this team represents. You know, there are people out there, particularly the Assad government, that will say, you know, the team itself is apolitical, that it's above politics, and is really it's like the one place where Syrians of all sides can unify and come together in peace. But there are a lot of people who see it another way, and so FIFA's basically taken the position of the Assad government that the team is outside of its jurisdiction, and that it represents unity.
You know, one of the remarkable aspects, one of the several remarkable aspects of the story, Stephen, is the personal aspect of it. When you talk to the players who are involved, players who've had to make difficult decisions, and balancing, I guess, sort of the natural instinct of an athlete to want to, you know, to want to play his career. I mean, to want to do what he believes he's been gifted with against the realities of the situation. You know, in particular, I'm thinking of, and forgive me if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but Firas Al-Khatib.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about him and his story. And sort of how, in a lot of ways, that's kind of so much of what this is about, kind of the twist and turns kind of come down, you know, on him.
Yeah, I do think that he really personifies, you know, a lot of the issues that we're talking about here. I mean, I was thinking about this a lot when I was working on the piece. You know, you guys and I, we've covered sports for a long time, and we cover, you know, decisions around sports, contractual decisions, lineup changes, you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, when you see somebody like Khatib, it sort of makes you puts those decisions that we cover with great, you know, hyperbole in perspective. And here's a guy who he's from Homs, which has been called the capital of the Syrian revolution. And Assad in 2011 attacked Homs, bombed it basically into oblivion, starved the population as a means of trying to get the city under control. And Khatib took a very public position. Firas Al-Khatib is one of the greatest soccer players to come out of Syria in the last 20 years. And Khatib took the position that he would not play for the Syrian national team again as long as bombs were falling on civilians anywhere in Syria. And he carried on that boycott for the next 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then there was basically that decision cost him the ability to see his family. It essentially estranged him from his country, even as the ground was shifting in Syria. So he had been affiliated with an opposition movement. You know, the war in Syria began with peaceful demonstrations all over the country, and then Assad attacked the population, and that led to the civil war, essentially. And so, but now, you know, as we know, the opposition in Syria is almost incomprehensible. It's so complicated. You know, you have Al-Qaeda and ISIS and warlords, and, you know, as Khatib put it, there are many killers now in Syria, and I hate them all is what he said. And so you know, he's aligned with an opposition movement that is not what it was when he first took his boycott, and so he decided, when we caught up with him, he was deciding whether to go back. And it was one of the most painful decisions that I've ever seen anybody faced with. He was crushed by it. And ultimately, he decided to go back. He's now representing the national team again. He says it was a soccer decision and not a political decision, that he's not taking sides in the war, that he's taken politics out of his sporting decisions. But then, you know, we saw him play in Korea in a qualifying match, and then like 5 days later, the Assad regime launched a chemical attack against the village of Khan Shukun, killing children and some 85 people, and it kind of laid out the stakes for mm-hmm. him. You know, he's now representing a government that is doing this, and you know, it just shows how difficult the situation is for the players. Like, there's no real right answers in any of this for the players, and they're just like most Syrians, just trying to do the best they can to, you know, for themselves and for their families.
Now, we should mention that Syria in Group A World Cup qualifying, now they're up against it. They're 4 points out
right.
with a goal differential of -1. Uzbekistan is third. South Korea is 13 points. Iran is 17. Syria has 8. I mean, it seems almost trite to throw out a table when we're talking about something like this. But
they're the kind of the team in exile, too.
But
Jeff,
they're
right?
a team. Well, and that's what I was going to say. You know, the other side of the sports story, I guess, is here's a team in exile that is, I mean, they've given a pretty good representation of themselves as athletes, as soccer players.
Yeah, it's kind of unbelievable, really. It's shocking. I mean, nobody will, you know, they can't play in Syria because of the war. FIFA won't let them play there. And nobody else in the Middle East will have them at this stage. And so they ended up, like, the very last minute playing in Seremban, Malaysia, which is about 40 miles south of Kuala Lumpur, in this ratty stadium before, you know, almost no Syrian fans. And, you know, they're with... If they play well, they could get into the next round. I mean, it's remote at this point. But to have reached this stage, which is the farthest they've gone since 1986 in 31 years, it's just kind of amazing. You know, and it's not only the logistical issues. It's, you know, Khatib hasn't been with them until really the last two games. Omar Suma, who's another star player, has also sat out the World Cup along with another star player, Jihad Hussein, who's also in Saudi Arabia. So they're missing some of their best players, and yet they've advanced really against all odds. And it's interesting because FIFA has sort of on its website and also in the press has portrayed this as kind of a heroic struggle, you know, against all odds, you know, overcoming all the challenges that they face in their country. And it is that. It's totally true. But at the same time, it's impossible to ignore that they're representing, you know, the Assad regime.
Well, like I say, just we got a minute here, but see, even in Malaysia, with that handful of Syrian fans, they unrolled a giant picture of Assad in the stands. You described.
Well, yeah, it was unbelievable. I mean, I was at this game, and you know, so I'm watching this thing play out, and you know, it's just they had flown in from Uzbekistan where they'd had their previous match, and you know, they're just tired and complaining about the whole thing, and yet they're hanging on to a scoreless tie against Korea, which is, you know, one of the powers in Asia, and then at the end of the match, the, you know, like 100 Syrian fans in attendance roll out this huge banner of Assad, and it's just stunning. You know, it's here's one of the world's most notorious dictators. The fans are celebrating him, and they're connecting him back with the team. And it just sort of, you know, you're in the middle of a soccer match, and then it's a reminder that, you know, there's much, much more at stake going on here.